Also like to welcome honorable members of this committee, the chairperson, CEO of GEPF, and officials from GEPF, staff of parliament, and the media. We have got one item today, which is the briefing by the GEPF on their annual report. The issue of pension now is on the news, because even unions want to take money from pension to bail out Eskom. So we don't know whether it's from GEPF or it's another pension fund, because there are many pension funds in South Africa. So it's a matter of national interest. So you are welcome, honorable members and the leadership of GEPF. Let me right away move straight to the item on the briefing by GEPF on their annual report. I don't know who will start, whether it's the chairperson, the doctor, or the CEO. The stage is yours.
Thank you, chairperson, and honorable members. It's a pleasure for us to be here to be able to report back to you on the annual report of the GEPF. We've structured the presentation as follows. I will do a brief introduction of the GEPF, following which the PEO will report on the financials of the GEPF. And when it comes to the discussion, there will be we will all three of us participate in providing whatever information that that is required by members. So as a start, just by way of background, who is the GEPF? I think many of you would know that the GEPF is the largest pension fund on the African continent, and that it was established by the Government Employees Pension Law of 1996. We have roughly 1.2 million members and about 464,000 pensioners and beneficiaries, and our assets under management are approximately 1.82 trillion. What is our objective? We are governed by GEP law, and our primary objective is to ensure that we provide pensions and other related benefits as determined in the GEP law to members, pensioners, and their beneficiaries. Consequently, we manage and administer pensions and related benefits on behalf of government employees in South Africa. We invest the funds that are contributed by members and the employer. We pay monthly pensions, child pensions, and spouse pensions. We also pay funeral and resignation benefits. The GEPF carries out these functions not just on its own, but working in conjunction with its agents, the Government Pensions Administration Agency, commonly known as GEPA, as well as the Public Investment Corporation. Despite this, however, I'd like to emphasize that the fund's administrative functions and its investment activities, while outsourced, remain firmly within our oversight role. I'd like to talk a little bit about our governance structure, which is the structure that enables us to play this oversight role and ensure that we perform our functions effectively at a governance level. We've got the Board of Trustees and a number of committees that are designed to focus on specific areas of our work. So we've got a Benefits and Administration Committee, and this committee looks at, amongst others, ensuring that the level of benefits and the types of benefits that are provided to our members are beneficial to them. So, for example, things such as the introduction of the funeral policy, funeral pension payout, as well as the level of that, I think that the Benefits and Administration Committee would focus on. And quite importantly as well, they play an important oversight role with respect to how GPAR performs its function relative to the services that the GEPF is required to provide to its members. We've got a Finance and Audit Committee which ensures that our financial controls and are in place and that risk is adequately managed. And then we've got a Governance and Legal Committee whose function is to ensure that at all times our governance processes and frameworks are appropriate and also plays an important role in instances where there may be legal issues that we have to deal with. The Investment Committee is responsible for oversight over investment matters and works primarily with the PIC in that regard and plays an oversight role in that regard on behalf of the board. And then finally, we have a Remunerations Committee which helps ensure that our human resource policies are appropriate to our needs. There are also subcommittees of two of the committees. The Finance and Audit Committee has a valuation subcommittee, and this is the committee which annually reviews the values of our investments as well as impairments, working together with independent valuators. And the Social and Ethics Subcommittee is a subcommittee of the Governance and Legal Committee, and its role is to ensure that our practices are ethical and appropriate from a social point of view. This is with respect not just to the board, but also with respect to the staff of the GPF. How is the Board of Trustees structured as the executive authority of the GPF? We have 16 members, 8 employer representatives, and 6 employee representatives, 1 pensioner representative, and 1 representative from the armed forces. And the board always, in its carrying out its functions, does so in terms of the powers and duties conferred to it by the GP law. And it ensures that the effective and efficient administration of the fund is carried out and is accountable for the investment performance of the fund. We view our work as being based on a number of pillars. The first of these is independence of trustees. So whilst we all come from different backgrounds and are nominated by various parties, once we are appointed as trustees, then we need to act independently and only in the interest of the members of the fund and its beneficiaries. Having trustees that are skilled and knowledgeable is also a critical pillar, and we carry this out by ensuring that annually all board members as well as the substitutes or trustees participate in various training programs. We identify key areas of focus, and there will be at least 4 training sessions for all board members, and in addition to that, committees may identify particular areas that they too would like to focus on. We are governed by a board charter, which we review regularly, as well as a governance charter. And then finally, our policies with respect to all the areas, whether it's administration, finance, HR, investment, and so forth, are regularly reviewed to ensure that they cover all the important areas and that they are effective in ensuring that we carry out our governance responsibilities. I've already touched a bit on the operating model of the GPF. We've got the GPF Board of Trustees, and the 2 major functions that we carried out are done through the Public Investment Corporation, which is our asset manager, and the Government Pensions Administration Agency, which is responsible for the fund's administration. With respect to the PIC, we've got an investment agreement and a mandate which governs how they are supposed to carry out their mandate or their functions in support of the GPF. And with respect to GPAR, we have a service level agreement which also we review regularly, and it sets out the level of performance and the standards of performance that we expect from GPAR. Of course, apart from these, we also work with other service providers, our external auditors, the actuarial evaluator, various legal service providers, and unlisted investment evaluators as well. So in a nutshell, this is who we are and how we are structured and operate as the GPF. I would now hand over to Mr. Sithole, who is the PEO, to talk us through the financial results. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just for the benefit of honourable members, is that a lot of the information that we have on governance you will find in the annual report. It starts in the annual report from page 13 of the annual report, and of course finishes where the financials actually finish. Let me just be quite precise. It'll be up to page 58. It deals with governance, and the part that the Chair has spoken about starts on page 13 all the way to page 18, dealing with the matters of governance. What I'm going to do now is to give you a high level of the financial results of the GEPF in the last year. The first one, of course, is to look at the assets. The green shows you where the assets are, and the blue shows you the liabilities, and you will see that the liabilities are shown only every second year. So between the blue and the assets, basically you see how well the assets are, how the fund is funded in on a minimum basis. We do evaluation every 2 years. Although the law provides for it to be done 3 years, we do it every 2 years just to make sure that we are on top of the relationship between the benefits that are promised to members and, of course, the assets that back those benefits. What you will see is that almost without fail, going back all the way to 2009, the assets of the fund have been relatively higher than the liabilities on a minimum basis. We are starting in March this year to do the next valuation, so next year when we report, you will see not only the assets in red, but probably again blue showing you what the liabilities are and the assets where we are. The good news is that I think the funds have continued to grow about 11.2% over the last 10 years, and that growth trend has continued as has been the case. And more important, just to reiterate that the assets are more than enough to cover the benefits that have been promised to members, their spouses and their beneficiaries. There's a very strong relationship between the assets and the investment portfolio, except for a small portion that speaks to the fixed assets that the GPS has. Most of the investment portfolio reflects what I think we have in the assets, so you will find that the numbers are not too far apart. And the good news is that although last year was a very difficult year, the GPF still managed to grow the asset base by 17 billion, giving a return of about 2.6%, which I'll come back to later. What I've done in the next slide is to give you a broad indication of where the assets of the funds are invested. In numerical terms, you will see that over close to a trillion of the fund's assets are actually invested in the listed equities market. Now that's quite significant because it speaks to the nature of the investments, the governance processes that are around there. Of course, it's not perfect, but it's actually a market-related type of investment. The same thing applies to domestic bills and bonds, largely, again, those investments that are made in the public domain, except maybe for one or two instances where specific locations might have been made, but those are, again, traded in the open market. And then, of course, our listed unlisted portfolio, which comprises just about 50 billion of the total, and of collective investment trusts making up the difference. There's been a slight decrease of 1% in the listed equities market through fair value adjustment, which is basically the movement in the share price overall of the investment that we've made in the listed investment. And then bonds are decreased by 2%, again, through negative fair value adjustments. There was no significant increase in domestic unlisted equities, so the 50 billion hasn't changed very much. And the foreign collective investment schemes increased by 10% as a result of the positive fair value adjustment, some of that related to the movement in the currency. In terms of investment returns, although last year wasn't good, at the end there, 2.6, it still remains positive. If you go back up to 2009, you will realize that for the last 10 years, the only time that we had a negative return was during the financial crisis. It is, of course, noticeable. I think that's the reason why we use graphs, that as the economy of the country has struggled, I think the overall performance of the GEPF in terms of the returns has tended lower, not necessarily consistently lower, but I think it has gone down quite significantly compared to where it was the year before. But again, relative to what the economy's performance was last year, 2.6 still remains a marginally better return than one would have expected. Our contributions received have continued apace, increased by about 5 billion from the year before. And the next one, of course, speaks to the benefits that have been paid. And again, there's been a continued growth in the benefits that we pay, although not as high as it was the year before. So the benefits have gone up to 103 billion in benefits that we've paid in total from the GEPF. I know that there's always concern about the fact that you have 103 billion in benefits paid, but there's only been 75 billion received in contributions. And then the question is, so what are the implications of that for the GEPF? Does it mean that we're running an unsustainable fund? Well, I think at the philosophical level, the reason that the GEPF exists is to pay benefits, so paying benefits is the primary reason why it's there. Of course, your first priority as a fund is to pay benefits to your pensioners or the spouses of those pensioners and their beneficiaries in the first instance, and then, of course, to pay benefits to members of the GEPF who are still active as they resign and change employment, or they get sick, or, of course, in the said case where they passed away, that their benefits are paid to those who they leave behind. So the challenge is seen as, so what makes up for the difference between 103 benefits paid and 75 contributions? And the reality is that the GEPF, of course, is investing in the different instruments that are indicated in the listed environment, in the bond space, and, of course, in the unlisted space as well as collective investment and property. And from those, we derive income. It comes in the form of interest in terms of our fixed interest portfolio. The bills, the bonds, the cash, they give us interest. And then, of course, for the rest of the investments, we have dividends that are flowing into the GEPF. The sum of those two, Musa, is 153 billion, 155 odd billion in total. So although we have 103 billion in benefits, we still have enough money to pay benefits without even having to realize any of the investments that have been made. So we don't have to sell any of the listed equities or sell any of the bonds to be able to pay benefits, because we still remain cash positive, as we say normally in our language. Then, just to give a sense of what the benefit, both the number of beneficiaries who receive benefits and the quantums that they received. Of course, the first one is important, is to pay our pensioners their benefits. the GPF processed and finalized 35,931 cases of members retiring during the year under review. So we added another, say, 36,000 new pensioners into the list of our beneficiaries who are pensioners, and we paid in total gratuities of 16 billion, and then annuities, which is the ongoing pension that we pay monthly, total to about 45.6 billion. Of course, our members do not always work for the public service for the rest of their life, and when they resign, we pay their benefits so that nothing stays behind in the GEPF. We paid 25 billion for a total of 23,000 GPF members who left the public service last year. Some of them, of course, may be coming back and getting re-employed in one form or fashion. And then the death benefits, we paid 4.8 billion in death benefits during the reporting year. For spouses, we added another 3,000 new spouses in the period. Funeral benefits, we paid close to 25,000 in benefits. This will be very closely related to the number of deaths that we experience. But of course, you must remember that for funeral, we're not only covering the members, we're also covering their spouses. Whether they are still active or they are pensioners, their spouses are covered when they pass away, as well as eligible children, those that are still below the age of majority as defined in GP law. And then over and above that, we pay child's pensions for those children who have lost a parent. It used to be that you had to lose two parents. The benefit improvements that the chair mentioned, amongst other things, the funeral benefit, one of the benefits that we improved was the child's pension. In the past, we used to have an orphan's pension where both parents had to have passed away before you could receive a GEPF pension, and the trustees, with the stakeholders, changed that benefit to become a child's pension where only we pay a benefit even if only one parent has passed away. And the reason for that is that we found that not all children, of course, lived or knew who the both parents were. They probably know one parent, and then if one parent passed away, you then have to go looking for the other parent when in actual fact you'd never known this other parent. So we've removed that, and we're paying regardless of whether there is another parent or not. And of course, where the circumstances are that you have two parents who are both members of the GEPF, you then get a benefit paid twice. Then, of course, the other important thing is that we can talk about the benefits. The other important thing is the experience that members have in engaging with the GEPF, which I think is quite important. It's not only just the payment of benefits, but the engagement of the GEPF. And, of course, we keep certain statistics to get a handle on our engagement with members. Close to 500,000 people visited GEPF offices in the last year. 90,000 were served by the mobile vans. The mobile units are the ones where we only have offices in a number of the major centers. We then, of course, realized that it cost our members a lot of money to come to the GEPF in those centers. We have a number of mobile vans located in the various provinces, and then they do the rounds to provide service closer to where members are, so that they don't have to travel as far to be able to be serviced by the GEPF. We, of course, one of the biggest things that we do is to respond to members telephonically, and this is probably where I think a lot of the aggravation that members have is experienced through our call center, but we service close to 700,000 people through our call center. We go to employers because a lot of the interaction between members and the GEPF happens at the employer level, so we spend a lot of time, we probably should be spending even more time to actually educate employer departments to be able to handle any queries at the call face, at the site where the members are, where they need any interaction that they might want and any understanding of the GEPF benefits and services. So we spend a lot of time trying to empower the employers as well. And then over and above that, there were close to about 12,000 employer sites, again, throughout the whole country. And then there's a special program that we undertake for those that are close to retirement, where we try to start having them thinking about their retirement and what kind of benefits they and the form of the benefits that they want to receive once they go on retirement. Just to remind the committee members, there was a list of benefits that were agreed to be changed, improved, or introduced, and those mostly have been completed so far. I'm going to talk about the ones that have been implemented. The chair spoke about the increase in the funeral benefit, where the benefit was more than doubled. I've already spoken about the implementation of the child's pension as opposed to the orphan's pension. The market value adjuster is simply a protection for members that when they leave the GEPF in the circumstance where, and this hasn't happened in the past, but you need to be prepared for this eventuality, that if the GEPF were to be underfunded, you still want members who leave to leave with their full benefit, and that to be paid off over a period of time by the employer. So the market value adjuster is to adjust the benefit in such a way that members who leave when the fund is underfunded, should such an eventuality occur, are not having a situation where their benefits are reduced because the fund was underfunded. They can leave with their benefits intact, and then the fund will then recover that over a period of time with the employer. This will happen in most instances if a significant employer like it, I don't think the Department of Health or the Department of Education were to decide they want to start their own fund, and that was an eventuality that needs to be catered for. The benefit discharge anomaly, this one is a situation where in the past, if you left the public service because you resigned, you received a different benefit to one where you were discharged. Although you were leaving, there was a difference between the benefit that you received. So what this has done was to ensure that regardless of whether you resigned or you were discharged, you're getting the same benefit, and that was the correction of that anomaly. There are two benefits that we are busy with, and we look to implement them before this calendar year. The additional voluntary scheme is where members who want to contribute additional money to their pension because of the tax dispensation, where currently the total contribution to the GEPF is about 22% of your pensionable salary, but the tax laws allow you to go up to about 27% and a half. So the difference, if you wanted to contribute the GEPF, there is this scheme that is being created to be able to enable members to do that. But of course, members have also the option to do that via other service providers outside of the GEPF through an annuity or whatever they want to be able to take advantage of that benefit. But we're creating the capability for them to do so in the GEPF. The other one is the preservation fund. I mentioned when I spoke about the resignation benefit that members have to take their benefits out of the GEPF, so there's no option right now for them to leave their money in the GEPF when they resign. So we are currently, and this has been approved, it just simply requires the appropriate administration capability to put in place, where a preservation fund will be created where those members that choose to leave their benefits behind the GEPF can do so. I think broadly that's what we wanted to share. Chair?
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson and the PEO. That's the presentation. Let me also acknowledge the presence of Mr. Adamas Stemmet and Mr. James Galvin. The two senior citizens come from an association for monitoring and advocacy of government pensions. You are welcome. Yeah. When we are old like you, we'll join you to be members of the association. Okay. Questions for clarity, members? Okay, let me write that down. Akbar, Professors, Louis, oh, Dr. George, are you here? When did you arrive? I didn't see you. Dr. George, Honorable Rips, Mshana, Ntate Mrulu, Mavileta, Honorable Abrams, Noxy. Okay, in that order. Akbar, Vessels, you can start.
Thank you so much, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. Firstly, with regards to your monitoring systems, do you think it's sufficient? And especially considering the findings with regards to the PIC and where the latest AG report also finds that there's non-compliance by the PIC on government governance processes, where there's not sufficient due diligence and so forth. Have you placed extra monitoring systems, especially from the board side? And what are you doing to prevent repetitions from what we know happened with certain investments and certain transactions, which the PIC made decisions on behalf of the GEPF, and where their mandate is there, but obviously there is a failure on their side to follow due diligence? Is the board actually taking more care in approving certain investments? And Chairperson, if you would allow me, I know it's not part of the annual report, but I think it is important to ask this question. We've seen in the media transactions that the PIC has acquired land on behalf of the GEPF at a completely ridiculous amount per hectare, it's a huge transaction. The question is, did the board approve that transaction? Or did the PIC do it on their own, and did they follow their own process without getting the approval of the trustees? Then with regards to administrative issues, and I see this very nice slide with regards to engaging our members and beneficiaries and figures, 518,000 visits to GEPF offices. The reality on the ground looks much different. Daily, we as members of parliament get complaints of constituencies where there is a lack of administrative processes in terms of the GEPF, where telephones aren't answered, where staff does not return telephone calls, where there's a complete lack of administration on the GEPF site, especially in rural areas. But overall, your national call centre, there's complaints about telephones aren't being answered. What are you doing to improve the administrative side of the GEPF? I also note that staff remuneration increased significantly from 2018 to 2019. It's almost a 30% increase. Why is that? And what is the reason for that significant increase? And can you also give us where's the most of your staff expenses? Is it in senior level? Where does that lie? Yes, thank you, Chair. That's it.
Thank you, Chairperson, and Mr. Sithole and Dr. McCarthy for your presentation. I do have a lot of questions on your annual report, but before I get there, I do want to just hone in on one massive proposed transaction that I'd like to ask your view on. I've seen your public statement on the proposal to use 254 billion rands worth of your funds to effectively bail out Eskom. But with respect, the public statement was equivocating. It wasn't clear. It made clear that you have not been formally consulted, which is, obviously extremely strange given how far this proposal has already gone. But it didn't make unequivocally clear where you stand on this proposal. for what it's worth, I think it's absolutely unacceptable to commit such an enormous chunk of funds over and above the, I think it's nearly 80, might be more than 80 billion, 84 billion that you already hold in Eskom debt, to an enterprise which, for all intents and purposes, is already completely bankrupt and is being kept alive by constant taxpayer bailouts. So I would just like to ask for your very clear and unequivocal view, please, on where you stand on the proposal to take 250 billion of your funds to bail out Eskom. My colleague has already raised the question around the land sale. That's obviously a much smaller transaction, but also equally worrying, and so I look forward to your answers there. Then, if I can just hone in on the issue of your reserve funding, if you could say a little bit more about that to us, because I read the paragraphs here from your annual report, where you say that the reserves that you calculate that you require are roughly 137.4 billion. In 2016, this was 222 billion. But then earlier on in the report, it says that you're currently holding a reserve of just 9.3 billion. So can you explain the discrepancy of those figures? I'll show you where I read that, just so that we're on the same page. On page 10, at the top of the page, it says an amount of 9.3 billion is currently held in the reserve account. So if you can just say a little bit more about how you calculate what reserves you need and why there has been such a precipitous decline in the reserves held, I'd be grateful. Then I also want to focus on the Isibaya portfolio. Late last year we had the PIC before us. I think you were actually here, but you didn't participate in that discussion very much. But you will remember that the PIC told us that roughly a third, more than a third of that Isibaya portfolio is underperforming. They classify it as underperforming. It's not delivering, which is obviously a source of concern. So what is there any update on that figure? Is that still the latest figure? And what action is GEPF taking to reconsider its Isibaya investments or to end that program or withdraw it or whatever the case may be? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks very much for the presentation. My colleagues have touched on some of your investments. I'm particularly interested in the unlisted equities and also the loan agreements, i.e. your bonds. Because if something was to go wrong with investments, and also we talk, if you look at the audit report, it does make reference to the valuation of the unlisted investments. We know that's always a difficulty. So I would like to get from you a list of those unlisted investments, and I also want to get a list of your loans, your investments in bonds. It might be a long one, but I do want it. Because what I'm particularly interested in is if, for example, you were going to invest in non-performing or underperforming loans, that would obviously impact on the return on the fund. And the return on the fund is fairly low. So I'm particularly interested in that. And also, the unlisted equities, obviously, if they aren't listed, then they haven't climbed over a particular hurdle, like, for example, at the JSE. So you obviously have a set of hurdles over which they must climb. But anyway, if I could just get a list of that, I would look at it with great interest. It was mentioned that there was a difficulty with the integrity of the information produced by the PIC in terms of the financial reporting purposes. Now, there was, in fact, also a problem in the political office bearers pension fund where the PIC had committed a rather egregious error. So the performance of the PIC is a bit problematic in my view. I would like to know from you whether you are satisfied with the administration of the PIC and whether they have made any errors in the valuations, specifically in bond portfolios or any other errors that have been brought to your attention? That's it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Honorable Mhlala.
Thanks so much, Chair. It is on public knowledge that the PIC is taking the poor people's money to bail out Eskom, close to 250 billion rand. So my question is, I'm just reiterating what the other comrade said. My question to you is, the PIC is your client. What is your take on this one? Are you agreeing with them, or what is your stand on this one? You know, I've also noticed that COSATU is also supporting this thing of taking the people's money, the poor people's money, to bail out Eskom. It has been many years that the pensions of public servants has been abused and wasted under the watch of COSATU and other trade unions. On many occasions, the PIC has dismally failed to act on behalf of the workers. The money lost in Steynhoff corruption scandal is lost forever and is unlikely to be recovered. So don't you think by taking the working class, the poor people's money, to bail out Eskom will cause the very same thing that happened to Steynhoff? The other thing is, we as the black people, the GEPF is the only thing that we are owning. We don't have dividends. We depend on labor benefits. So we are against this thing of taking the poor people's money. These ruling elites, we know very well what they do is always to access capital, but they can't get, they can't create their own, in this capital they can't get the revenue in all those things. They always up to corruption and all those things. So we are worried about the pension fund money. Are we not going to be involved in all these sort of corruptions and all those things like it happened in Steynhoff scandal? Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Rolum.
Well, thank you very much. I don't have a lot of questions. But just the first comment is that I would advise that in future that we place in a tabular format, you know, contributions received, contributions paid out, and accumulative change in value. Two, we've read media reports to the extent that I know we are burdening you with matters related to PIC, but we've read media reports to the effect that there was an overpayment of a land in Klerksdorp for purpose of development. I would want to know, what is your view on this matter, and what is your relationship with PIC given the governance challenges that are there? The last question is, what is the exposure of SOE debt, a cumulative exposure of SOE debt? Thanks.
Thanks, Honorable Mavila.
Thank you. Mine also is just two. You mentioned that there is a new investment committee that does oversight to the PIC. Can we just maybe one day just to get what is it that they're doing, the oversight step by step, so that we've got a comfort that indeed there's something that they're doing. And here on the GPF, the benefits, on the spouse, I see only pensions were processed. But when I read from the beginning up to, I see processed and paid. I don't know, it's only processed on the spouses, they were never paid. Maybe you can just check it there. Maybe there's error, spelling error or something, omission. Because if they were not paid, we would like to know why is it only processed on the benefits. Nah? You see that one? On spouse annuity. A total of 284 claims for spouse pension were processed during the reporting period, but there is no paid. So I'm just worried.
Okay. Honorable.
Thanks, Chair. Thank you so much for the presentation. It's much appreciated. Chair, we see that there are some achievements during the period under review. Now, is there somewhere where we can get where you had set your targets and achievements so that we know that the presentation is matched against that? secondly, Chair one wants to speak on the issue of the audit opinion. There are matters of emphasis there, and I think without really reading them out to you, you know that they do relate to the PIC governance, for example, the unlisted investments, and so on. So could you talk to how you are working on those so that we do not find a repeat in the near future? Chair, my other questions are on the presentation itself. You know, it's well and good for us to find that there's been so many visits, 510,000 visits of pensioners to your offices. But do you not, as GPF, have some awareness programs that will go voluntarily to talk to the people even before retirement, before the time comes, so that when the time comes, people make the best choices about what needs to be done going forward with their money. The other area that is a bit worrying as well is the issue of children. I heard Musa talking to the issue of how we make sure that all the children are covered, even those that are outside marriage. This is always a worrying factor because in many cases the issue, the reality is that when times come for death, there's mourning, and then immediately thereafter there's claiming, and the other child who's outside marriage is not considered. And in most cases, I have a recent case, for example, in King Williamstown, where the child has had to go to court by himself because the processes were way gone, and he was not getting any feedback, but he did fortunately discover that his siblings were actually continuing with claiming without him. So how do we ensure that all children, because it's imperative, because when men make children, they must take care of them even after death. There's another question, but I think I have covered it in the targets question because I saw that you just put the figures where you say this is the achievement, and I was not able to see whether if you put a number for an achievement, we do not know what the target was, and therefore for me, we can't really say that's a good performance because we don't know against what are we measuring. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, honourable members. GPF, can you respond to those questions?
Thank you, Chair. So we will endeavor to answer all the questions. Some will be answered by me and then others by Abel and Musa. Let me start with the question around, because I think it has come up at least twice, the question around oversight. Is it sufficient? I want to first just set the framework that we have for monitoring the PIC and also clarify the roles of the different entities in the investment process. So the first item, I believe, in having an effective oversight process or mechanism is to have a policy framework. So we've got an investment policy and we've got the investment mandate. And the investment mandate is and policy are guided by a strategic asset allocation, which ensures that the fund's liabilities are matched with whatever asset growth that we seek to achieve. So the framework enables us to ensure that we focus on a key variable that determines whether or not we're going to meet our liabilities through the way that we invest members' assets. And that's the policy framework and the strategic asset allocation. Then we have governance structures that are designed to ensure that that mandate is implemented and that it's adequately and that the implementation is adequately monitored. The PIC, together with its board, with the PIC board having oversight, is responsible for implementing that mandate. So the investment decisions actually take place at the PIC, not at the GEPF. And then we monitor those the implementation of that mandate. The governance structures that we have are our board and the investment committee. At the implementation level, there is a PIC GEPF exco, which meets in between our meetings and as and when necessary to focus on specific issues and help. There's another layer at an operational level that helps with ensuring that there's adequate monitoring and communication between the two parties. We also, between the GEPF and the PIC, have instituted mechanisms at the governance level to allow the trustees and the directors to have regular communication as issues arise and to share information. The chair of the PIC and myself have a standing agreement to meet as often as we can, but at least quarterly. There's a standing agreement for the government, for the boards of the two entities to meet twice a year. One meeting focusing on PIC strategy and our strategy to ensure alignment, and the next meeting designed to look at how it is that we are progressing on those issues. The two investment committees of the entities also meet on a quarterly basis. Now, these structures have worked variably depending on circumstances. At the moment, they are working very well. At other points, when we've had turnover in the chairperson of the PIC, they have not worked as well at the board-to-board, but the investment committee to investment committee structures have worked much better. At the GPF level, the investment committee meets on a quarterly basis and receives reports from the PIC. It is during this reporting process that we assess how the performance of the assets is going, and in addition to that, pick up on any issues that are of concern to us as the GPF with respect to the implementation of the mandate. This is a dynamic process which allows us, at points where we feel that there is a need for intervention, to signal to the PIC the changes that we would like to make in the monitoring process. So, for example, we have a process that, a policy that requires that any investment above 2 billion rands comes through to the GEPF, not for approval, but so that we can have line of sight of those investments. We've also looked at some of the policies that the PIC has and practices. For example, they have a structured investment products policy, and assets that are implemented through that policy, and we have asked that that particular policy be placed on hold. So as and when we feel that there's a need for us to intervene, we do intervene. And I must say that the ExCo to ExCo process also works quite well. So the approach that we have taken is that we do have an investment policy, we've got an investment mandate, but we're very alive to the fact that this is not a static process, and that if there are issues that emerge, we should be ready to, you know, to address those issues. There's a question that was raised about the land acquired by the PIC that has been reported in the newspapers. We have asked the PIC for a report on that issue. We are waiting for a full report on that matter, and as soon as we've received it and analyzed what it is that they have to say, we'll be able to express a view on it. This is not something that the GPF would have approved, because it's part of the PIC investment process, so it's the PIC through its various structures that would have approved the purchase of that land. Do you want to indicate anything?
Yeah, I think it's very difficult to say more until such time that one actually gets the detail. But on broad terms, I think we do via the PIC buy land in advance of our development. And in this instance, although people saying it's farmland, it's actually rezoned land for a mixed use development that. In some time in the future, needs to be developed. And the numbers that I have seen is that I think independent valuations for the redeveloped property I think was presented, and I think based on what the valuator had actually recommended, the indication is that we paid a fair price for the land. Given where it currently stands. But I think, as the Chair says, we will respond in detail while that has happened. But it is not unusual for the GEP via the PIC to look for areas of development, especially in areas where we're not currently focused on. Currently, a lot of our property investments tend to be in urban areas, and we're looking to move away from the big urban areas to look for other avenues of development outside of that, and then to buy land in anticipation of future development. And therefore, the details, I think, do need to be addressed, but the actual approach is not it's not new, it's not unreasonable.
On staff increases, do you want to deal with that?
Payroll. The issue around payroll, I think we just increased the number of staff. It doesn't necessarily mean that we have given unreasonable increases to the existing staff. Is that we fill the vacancies that were open, and therefore your total staff complement would have increased, and therefore the remuneration would have gone up. Commensurate to the number of people that you have actually added into your staff component. I think there was from Honourable Mr. Fester, there was another question that you asked, which I think has come a number of times later, the issue around administration and service to members. So the issue there is... Yes, we provide those statistics. We are aware of the challenge that I think we need to address in terms of improving the service. And I think it's a difficult one because you're dealing with a situation we pay close to about some 40,000-50,000 members benefits that we actually pay every year. While it is not acceptable, I think we cannot deny that things do go wrong in the payment of some of those numbers of members that we pay, as well as the engagement, either via our call center or if they come to the offices, that things do go wrong. But I think in the GPF context, it's always important to not overstate the percentage, because the percentage hides the number of real human beings behind them. So if I say we're paying 85% of all benefits without any major concerns, it may sound like the 15% doesn't matter, but the 15% is in the instance of the GPF speaks to thousands and thousands of members who might not be happy with the experience that they have with the GPF. But I think it is also important to understand that in the broader context, there are benefits that are paid on time, paid correctly and appropriately. But of course, there is this percentage that we are working on to improve to pay. And we are very, very alive, as is the board, to the reality that there are areas where there needs to still be a lot of improvement in the way we pay benefits to members. And this affects mostly people who exit while they're still in service. I know that there are some pension representatives here, but the experience we have is that once most benefits are paid in the pension sphere, there's hardly any major problems that actually arise in the payments of benefits. The only instances that we would actually have in pension benefits happens when pensioners live outside of the South African jurisdiction, and then there are problems either with bank accounts or there are problems with life certificates. But in most instances where pensions are concerned, there's hardly any issues. But on exits, we know that there is still a lot of work that we need to do to improve the service that we're providing, and we are working on it. I think that was the issue from Honorable Fesser. And then from Honorable Lewis, there was another issue that I think you asked, specifically on the Eskom bond, and this one came a number of times. So Chair, if I answer it, I will not repeat the answer because I think the answer will remain the same. We're not equivocating on the Eskom bond. It is a fact that we have not been approached. I think you may find it difficult to believe that people could make the statements that they've made without coming to the GPF. That's the fact. So I don't think we can change that. And the GPF can't say anything other than what I think is the truth, that we were not approached. We have to this day not been approached. So it's not equivocation, it's just a fact. But then I think that when you're talking about equivocation, it's more about how will we respond in the future when we are approached. Now, the difficult thing is that you can't say that until you get a firm proposal with a number of things and then assess it on the merits of that. Yes, we currently are exposed to Eskom to the tune of 84 billion. Of course, in our fixed income portfolio, it is sizable, but in the total scheme of the GPF's funds in totality, it is not. But we still need to look at it in relation to our fixed income portfolio, where it is a sizable amount of money that we've committed to Eskom. But I think the reason why we can't say categorically that we will not consider is because it may very well be that an approach is made that makes perfect sense to the GPF. I know that, for instance, a year or two ago, we had to come to this committee to talk about the 5 billion that we gave to Eskom, for instance, in a bridging loan of 5 billion. And there was a lot of unhappiness about that. But that was actually a very good investment for the GPF. It served the purpose of the GPF. So the reason why we do not make categorical statements about the future is because it may well be that a very good deal, for lack of a better word, is presented to the GPF, and then it will be untoward for the GPF to dismiss it outright without having to consider it. So our approach is, if we approach, we will look at whatever it is that is presented and look and say, is it to the benefit of the GPF? And if it is, we will be not doing our work if we don't consider it. And of course, there's the other broader consideration is to say, I think we can't pretend that we are not in this country, and therefore we are part of looking for the solutions that I think are facing the country to the extent that that are done with the main objective of the fund in the forefront of that consideration. So that's not equivocation, it's simply the reality. We can't make statements until we know what statements we can make. When the facts are presented, the details are presented, we'll consider. Then you asked a question about differences in number of reserving. I'm not sure, the only 9 billion that I can see attributed as reserve is money that was put aside to address what we call past discriminatory practices, the 9 billion. So that reserve is not a reserve in the general GEPF. So what it is that if you go back about 21 years ago, there was an agreement between the employer and the employees to look at certain category of members who were disadvantaged by specific events. For instance, if there were some the strikers in Ciscar who were fired and then reinstated and lost service because of that kind of a process. So there was a category of members where there was an agreement between the employer and the employees to compensate them for how they were treated in the past. And then there was this money that was put aside to the value of 9 billion to actually provide for this reserve. So that's the reserve that's there. That's not the reserve, the GPF in general, but that's for a specific purpose. But you ask another kind of a bigger issue around reserving and the size of the reserve. Now, the reserve that you refer to, the bigger reserve, is the one that the actuaries calculate. So if the actuaries do evaluation on two bases. One that they call the minimum funding level basis. That one simply says, which of course theoretically you can do it, but in practice doesn't happen that way. It says, if the GPF were to be liquidated today, so if for some reason we had to pay all our members and all our beneficiaries all the monies that they are due, what monies would we need to have to be able to pay them? And that is evaluation on the minimum funding level. Now, the actuary has done that, and then what they have confirmed is that for every rand of benefit that we have promised, if we were to have to pay every...
Mr. Stoll, don't run a lecture.
Oh.
I know you are passionate about this subject. Just respond to questions, because members, you see, this is a very tight week for all of us. The president is here. We are going to the assembly not so long. So let's go straight to questions. If you have responded to one of them, fine.
So I think the point is that the additional risk is purely insurance that I think the actuaries make provision for, just in case things go wrong, not in the short term, but in the long term. So that's the difference. But I think I can explain that to you outside of the meeting. Honourable George, you asked a question about the unlisted. We do have, we can't put all the investments of the fund in the annual report, but we do have, if you go to the GPF website where the annual report is, you will find two things. You'll find a list of all the GPF's listed investments and all the GPF's unlisted investments, including both unlisted equities and unlisted loans. So that already is in the public domain. It's just that can't put it in a single document, but it's available for you. Isibaya, the one-third performance that I think remains, by and large, it hasn't changed very much. I think it's sitting at about 56% currently of performing, 56% performing and the difference non-performing. The only thing that I need to say about that is that the fact that it's not non-performing doesn't mean it's necessarily bad. Some of it actually comes right after a period of time. So at any given time, that number will move. Of course, there are some bad ones where they have been impaired down to zero, which are actually indicated in the report. But simply the fact that it's not performing right now does not mean that it's forever non-performing. No, there was a question around... are we satisfied with the PIC? On the large portfolio we are. I think, again, if and this is the difficult thing about the PIC, that when you look at their performance on the portfolio as a whole, they've actually delivered for the GEPF over many, many years. Now, of course, when you go to the granular, the detail, then you identify problems in the details, which I think, as the chair has indicated, there are processes to address those. But when you look at the PIC in totality, they actually have done very well for the GEPF. It doesn't mean that we're not addressing some of the issues that need to be addressed in particular. Steinhoff is, I think it has come to this committee, so I, you know as much as I know the challenges of Steinhoff. Steinhoff was a listed entity, so the issue is, have we changed our holding in Steinhoff? And the answer is no. We, by and large, still have the same holding, but the share price has, of course, decreased quite significantly, and that's where the value as it currently stands is very, very little, and we're not really seeing it improving quite significantly in that regard. But it's not just money that we're not trying means and ways to actually recover where we are able of recovering. The extent of SOE debt.
Is that the information?
If you go to page 90 of the annual report, we give the list of all our exposure, debt exposure, the big ones, and the big SOEs are listed there. So we're actually quite transparent about the total debt that we hold for state-owned enterprises in totality. So you will find the list of all the ones that we hold there. And then, Honorable Maglicha, you had the investment committee. I think the chair has addressed the issue around the methods of emphasis. Musa?
Thanks, Chair. The auditors were just highlighting that the GEPF prepares its financial statements according to the regulatory reporting requirements issued by the Financial Sector Conduct Authority. So they are emphasizing that the financial statements may only be used for those purposes, and their audit report is in line with those regulatory reporting requirements. They are not based on international financial reporting standards or any other accounting standards. That is the matter of emphasis. The other issues maybe that you were touching on were the key audit matters that the auditors were highlighting, which relate to the Public Investment Corporation, the issues identified on the governance failures. The auditors have responded on what the processes they undertook to address those key audit matters that they had identified. Valuation of unlisted investments is also another sensitive area in the accounting of our investments, and the auditors also explained what part they played in verifying the work that was done there. Similarly, on the valuation of benefit payable provision, as well as the contribution and funding level, they also do test on the work done by the actuaries. So they're just highlighting the sensitive areas, risky areas of the business that they've done work on to give us comfort around them.
Now that you can find on pages 63 and 64 of the annual report. Okay, so then there was a question around has the PIC made mistakes? Now that's a very interesting question because I mean the reason why there's engagement between the executives of the GEPF and the PIC and the committees and the governance structures is by and large to address things that I think needs to be addressed on an ongoing basis. So the truth is mistakes are made, of course, in the daily operations of the PIC with regards to how it manages the GEPF, but none of it is of a structural, strategic nature. It's matters that between the executives, and of course if it goes beyond that, it gets escalated, addressed between the executives or the appropriate monitoring and evaluation structures of the GEPF. But to go beyond that, other than what I think has been addressed in the Mbati Commission, we have not identified any structural challenges that we want to share with the committee. Services, programs, children's pension, I think there was the awareness program. We do have an awareness program for people who are getting closer to retirement, I think what we need to do is to expand it and do more. The board at their last strategic session focused on this particular issue around advising members, because we're discovering that a lot of members are making decisions that we think are not to their benefit, and we're looking for a mechanism to do more in terms of engaging them earlier before they have to actually leave. We can only, of course, engage. We cannot dictate what members do. They have the freedom to either retain their benefits in the GEPF or to move them somewhere else. I don't think that will ever change. The thing there will be to simply empower them to understand their benefits sufficiently to make the decision whether to stay with the GEPF or to go elsewhere. So we take the point that we need to do more, and we will do so. If you want to look at some of the engagement that we have, different aspects with the members, you will find that on page 50 of the annual report, where we give more details of the kind of things that we do to address members as they get closer to pensions and, of course, when they are in service. There was a question around the children's pension and children outside of marriage. In terms of GP law, we are required, and this is where sometimes death benefits take a long time to pay, we are required to go beyond just the obvious. So we're not going to simply go and say, well, show us your immediate family after death. We are required to do an investigation that goes beyond just the children that are known. But of course, the challenge always is you need somebody to tell you that to be able to know if there are children that are not necessarily disclosed either by the member or the immediate member's family once they've passed away. But I'd like to assure the member that we endeavor, and I'm sure we fail in some instances, but the law requires that we include all dependents, all children of deceased members, regardless of whether they were living with a member or not. That is what we are required to do. If we fail, it is purely a failure of administration. Chair, I think we've covered all the questions that have been asked.
Okay. We'll take follow-up questions. Remember, members, we still have an outstanding meeting with PIC where they should come back and report on the debts, some of which have been written off, some of which we are not sure whether there is a recovery strategy. If you remember when we met them at, I think it's 90 Play, we raised the matter that sooner this year they should come back. Because there was an issue that was identified by the Auditor General in regard to the problem of debt management. So we have that outstanding meeting. And I heard the President saying that he will release the party report soon. I think the sooner the President releases this report, the better, so that we are able to deal with these issues of GEPF and PIC in a comprehensive manner. Hopefully, the report or the commission has gone into details dealing with the issues that have been raised. Probably when PIC comes back or sooner, we might want to invite the unions and PIC and GEPF to talk about this 250 billion rand. It's a matter of public interest. I think the sooner, Alan, we call them, the better. We will have to amend the program, because it's out there in the public domain. And when you talk about pension, it's a very sensitive matter to everyone who's a contributor. And I saw, Honorable Abrams, did you see the video of Louis? Yes, the video. He will share it with you. He has got a video. Eh? It's trending. I'm Hill Lewis, Member of Parliament. These crooks are these crooks are taking your pension. So the sooner we call the unions and PIC and GEPF to talk about this matter, Honorable Mhlala, I think the better. If possible, Alan, let's see if in the next week or two we can get PIC, GEPF, and the unions to come here to explain to us this ESCOM bailout issue. Honorable Wessels, Honorable Lewis, Kotsana, in that order. Honorable Abrams, those will be the follow-up questions and comments.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the answers. Firstly, with regards to the land, the Palmietfontein land, is there a deadline for that report that you've set to the PIC, and can we be privy to what the date is when they will report to you on that matter? If I can just comment on that as well, what the GPF and especially the trustees should also take into account is the fact that the municipal pension councillors fund was involved in the same transaction. There was a settlement with them for 120 million rand, which is the biggest settlement in those terms, because of the transaction and the fact that it wasn't a valid transaction. In the settlement letter from Izagu's attorneys to the Municipal Councillors Pension Fund, they mention that they will only make the payment of the 120 million rand once they receive the money from the GEPF for this transaction that we're now referring to with the payment of the two pieces of land. It's actually absurd. So take that into account. And the other thing is, I hear what the principal officer is saying with regards to the valuation. But what is not being taken into consideration is that a lot of the extent of that land is dolomite, and it's not development. You can't develop that land. Izagu bought that land for 2 million rand. So take that also into consideration. But the deadline for reporters is the most important question with regards to that. Then staff, now you increased the number of employees. Can you tell us how many employees are currently employed by the GEPF? But what worries me is if you say it's not related to salary increases, what we can see in the annual report is that the principal officer's salary increased with almost 19% in 1 year. Is that, in the current financial state that the whole country is in, is that responsible to give us a salary increase of almost 19% to a senior executive? With regards to the PIC, the question is, I hear all these measures and quarterly meetings and investment committees meeting. Are these new measures, or has this also always been in place? If it has, it failed with a lot of transactions and money that was lost. So isn't it time to review the mandate and review the monitoring system? Because with transactions such as AO Technologies, that system that the chairperson now mentioned did not work. It didn't prevent the losses that occurred there. With VBS, it didn't prevent the losses that occurred there. So isn't it time to review the mandate for the PIC, especially in terms of the fact, and I want to reiterate it, that they do not comply with what they are supposed to comply with. The HE findings are that they don't comply with governance processes. They don't have their own measures in place. So is it not the responsibility of the Board of Trustees to act on behalf of the pensioners out there and put better measures in place and review the mandate? Then just a quick new question that I didn't remember of. I see you owe the government pensions at administrative agency 84 million rand, according to the annual report. Why would that be? It's an account payable. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. Just to follow up on the Palmietfontein deal, you mentioned that you got an independent valuation of that land as rezoned and after development. I wonder if you could please send that valuation to the Secretary. Then I must say it does strike me as weird that you still haven't got a report from the PIC given that this deal has had wall-to-wall media coverage, there are serious questions around it. I mean, surely the PIC could come to your office that same day and just give you the facts on that deal. Why, you know, it's now 2 weeks later and you still don't have the facts. I must say, I think that is weird and not actually acceptable. So I accept your answer on the COSATU proposal of the ESCOM bailouts. However, I understand that you've got to look at it when it is presented to you. The point I was making was firstly that it's not really acceptable that it still hasn't been presented to you when it is being discussed in the highest echelons of government and in some cases already as a fait accompli. But the person or the organization who is actually paying the money has not yet been consulted. This is not on. But secondly, let me rephrase my question as follows. Would it, in the ordinary course of business, be acceptable for the GEPF to invest 335 billion rand of its assets, about 18.5% of your total assets under management, in one asset? Not in one asset class, in one specific asset. Then, just on the reserve, can you just say what your current reserve is? I appreciate your answer that clarified my question, but if you could just say what the current reserve is. And then one new question, if I may, on the potential of a Moody's downgrade on the 27th of March. That would mean that sovereign bonds and parastatal bonds would lose investment grade rating. What consequence would that have for your bond holdings? You're currently holding about 510 billion rand in government and parastatal bonds, and would there be any forced sell down? Thank you.
Thanks so much, Chair. I suggest in terms of the invitation to COSATU and other unions, we must not forget unions like SAFTU and NUMSA. They've got a lot of membership, I think, in terms of workers' representation. So can we please extend the invitation to them? Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Chair. Just one question that I omitted. I wanted to find out how much of your balance sheet comprise unclaimed benefits, and what steps have you put in place to try and track down beneficiaries? Thanks.
Kosa?
No, thanks, Honorable Chair. I see here that the GPF investment yielded an average return of 2.6% in 2019 compared to the 8.5% in 2018. And this has been the worst return on investment since 2009. So what could be the reason for that? Because in the past 10 years, from 2009 to 2019, this is the worst return on investment that the GPF has had. The second question, I just want to find out what is it that you are now doing differently in terms of how you relate with PIC since the Steynhof accounting scandal? Well, I've heard the chair of the board indicating that she is meeting with the chair of the PIC board on quarterly basis. But then besides those meetings, what is it that the GEPF is doing differently in the manner that you relate to the PIC in order to avoid such scandals? Thanks so much.
Thanks, Honorable Abrams.
Mr. Stone, I found my specific question around, I think it's Moses' question, on your presentation around the processed and finalized cases where you say you've processed and finalized 35,931. That's where my question was based on. what then? You know, sometimes percentages may fool you, but in such cases you need to know out of how many are we talking. And then, Chair, there's a question which I suspect might be contained in the brown booklet about the human resource issues of a GEPF, whether like the staff complement your vacancies and so on, that kind of thing. And Chair, on a lighter note, but I need an answer on this one, although it's on a lighter note. I see that when you give us the constitution or how your board is constituted, you also tell us their ages. I just wondered at that consideration what informed it. I'm saying it, Mr. Story, in case when I get out of Parliament I become one of the board members. I don't want to, my age to be divulged. Maybe just tell us what informs that. And much as you know that area is the area of the minister, but one is also interested to know, do you have, I mean, how are the board, the board of trustees engaged or appointed? You know, is it through structures? Because as I can see, the constitution of the board of trustees seems to be taking cognizance of all areas that are concerned with pensions and pensioners. Thanks, Chair.
Okay, thanks. GPF, then you responded to the question. In Afrikaans, they say kort en bondig.
Okay, on the deadline for the report, we will be considering this report at our investment committee meeting, which is coming up in March. In between that, though, there's going to be interaction between the executives in order to ensure that we have all the information that is required for us to reflect on that on the report. And thank you for the additional information that you've provided. On the salary on the salary issues or the staff complement, let me make two points. The first is that as part of ensuring that we improve in all the areas that the GPF is responsible for, investment monitoring. So we've increased the number of staff in that area. We've also increased staff in communication and upgraded the position, the communications position, because it's a critical area for us to ensure that we communicate with our members more effectively. And so those are some of the areas that we have where we've increased staff. We've also benchmarked the salaries of the staff, particularly the PEO, and we've increased a bonus system, short-term incentive system as well. The idea that we have as a board is that we do not want to have a very large staff complement. However, we do want high-caliber staff that will ensure, that will enable us to monitor and engage with our agents appropriately. We are in the process reviewing the mandate of the GPF. We do this periodically. We were in the process of doing it even before the Empathy Commission came into being. I think what is important as well to note in terms of your questions on IO and VBS is the separation of responsibilities between the GPF and the PIC. So the issues around investment and investment decision-making processes are matters that sit with the PIC. What we have done periodically as issues arise is in those board-to-board engagements highlight our concerns with the governance body of the PIC and also ask them to provide us with information on their investment processes and indicated where we feel that they need to strengthen or change their investment processes based on what we're picking up as weaknesses that in the when matters get reported to us. Then there's a follow-up on EPSCO.
Just to add to what the chair has said on VBS and IO, I think Honourable Vessels asked the question around people circumventing process. That's in most instances wrongdoing, and it's very difficult to act in advance of wrongdoing, because you put processes in place and you expect everybody to behave properly, and when they didn't do wrong, then you deal with them. And I think in the case, and I must be careful now what language I use, because I mustn't sound like I'm a judge, because I don't know for a fact, but the indications on IO and VBS, especially VBS, we know there was wrongdoing by certain individuals who were put there to act in the interest of the GPF and the PIC, but they acted quite wrongly. Now, that kind of thing you can't really preempt. So I think it's one thing to appreciate the processes that are in place and the policies, and the people adhering to them, and you hope that people, that you have processed to make sure they do so. Chair spoke about the review of mandate, but there was a specific question that was asked about the GPA debt. It's not debt, it's the fee. So the GPA is paid a fee by the GPF, and then we divide it over 12 months and we get paid over them. So that's a fee, it's not a debt. There was a question about the impact of the downgrade on the bonds. So there are two possible answers. The bonds that we already own, we bought them when the rating was good, and we got certain conditions that came with them. For instance, most of it's government guaranteed, and it has also a guaranteed return. Now, that is not going to change if there's a downgrade. It will stay the same. The only challenge that it affects your trading, so your yield might change. So what you might have to do is just to hold it to maturity, and then you get your capital and you get your interest rate. So that's the kind of, in the short term, the impact that would have. But of course, the impact on the economy and the rest of the investments, that's another consideration. But if you were to ask for analysts, they will say, by and large, I think a downgrade has already been priced into the South African security. So there might be an immediate response, which will stabilize. So basically, the price as you currently see it in the market probably reflects what the aftermath of a downgrade will be. But again, that's speculation. You don't know until a downgrade comes, and then you have to deal with the consequences of that. There was a question about unclaimed benefits. Musa, you want to address that?
Thank you, Chair. The extent of the unclaimed benefits is 0.05% of the assets under management. And the question that you asked about what are we doing to address unclaimed benefits, I think it centers around the definition of unclaimed benefits. In terms of the FSCA, unclaimed benefits comprise those benefits that you know are payable to people who have exited the fund, have claimed, but there are administrative challenges for a period of 2 years where we have not paid those claims. They are unpaid, but after 2 years they revert back to unclaimed. So some of them we do know about, the majority of the 863 million we do know about, but we're sorting out issues around the paperwork on exit. So there is communication in that regard.
Well, it's a question that I think you asked, I kind of glossed through it. You asked a much more difficult question. Would we invest 300 billion in a single entity? Not ordinarily. I mean, the closest we've come to that was Naspers. Naspers, the reason it was because it grew. Sometimes we look at it after the fact and we think it's bad, but actually it got there because we bought it and then it grew quite substantially. And then we end up with about 25% of Naspers. But from a prudential investment perspective, you would not want to hold that extent of a percentage in a single shareholding. So that, I think, is a fair comment that you would want to do that.
I think just to add to what the PO has said is to just reemphasize the fact that the GPF, as part of its of prudence in the way that it invests ensures that its strategy is aligned to its liabilities through a strategic asset allocation. And the strategic asset allocation framework basically enables you to ensure that the kind of risks that you take are commensurate with the sort of returns that you are getting. So that's the framework that within which we would consider any such investment as well.
Then there was a question around the return, the 2.6. Why is that it's low compared to what has been historically? That is true. It's the lowest since we had the financial crisis in 2009. The reason is that the economy last year didn't do very well. 90% of the GPF's investments are invested in the South African economy. While there's no causal relationship between the return and the economic performance, there's a very strong correlation, so they move in tandem. So the economy last year grew at 0.7%, especially the equities market grew at that level, and we actually did better than that. And the reason is that we do have investments that are much more guaranteed, so to speak. For instance, our fixed our income portfolio gives us a return that is much more certain. So yes, the performance is not good, but that has to do with the fact that we are so heavily invested in the South African economy, and then we tend to reflect how the economy is performing. What are we doing differently in terms of Steinhoff? That is something that the PIC, I think, does, is much more vigilance in analyzing your investments, is doing better in due diligence in your investment processes. I think that's the change. And I know that when I was here last time, the PIC made this point, is that sometimes you need to be careful not to follow simply what everybody is doing and take a contrary view and analyze things. The only challenge, of course, is that the GPF is so big that we invest some of our investment passively. So you tend to invest in all the big stocks in relation to their size in the JSE, we index basically. So you end up even investing in entities according to how the index says you must invest, as opposed to looking at an individual investment. So to some extent, that's part of the reason why we end up in some of the exposures that we currently have. The difference, sorry, Honorable Abrams, I didn't avoid it. I just missed the question that you initially asked about the difference between processed vis-a-vis paid. Paid means it's done. So it's a timing issue. So the fact that we receive any benefit, I think the spouse is just one. So when we receive it, at the date of accounting, we have to account for it as received, although it's not paid, but it will be paid immediately thereafter. So it's just a timing issue. That's all that it is. In terms of presentation of the information that we present, we don't follow necessarily the Treasury way of presenting our performance, but we hear that in the future we'll have to tabulate in a manner, because there's no reason why we can't, although we're not necessarily required to do so, that we can present it in a manner that I think the committee members are familiar with because of the other public institutions that report to the committee. The process of appointing, let me address the issue around staff. There was a question that was asked about staff. On page 42 of the annual report, we actually give the structure of the GEPF staff complement. We have a staff of 43 and there were 12 vacancies. So on page 43, you will find the structure of the GEPF there. Yeah. It was 32 before, and it's grown to 43. I think that's where the increase that you asked came from. There was a question about the appointment of the board, how the board of trustees appointed. And this is in GP law, so it's provided for in GP law. So GP law provides for three kinds of appointment, no, four. So there is the nominations by the employer, which are done by the employer department. So the Minister of Finance is tasked with signing off on the trustees that represent the employer. And they tend to appoint the bigger
employers, the big departments, education, health, the police, the defense force, to make sure they're represented. And there's also two experts that are brought into the board to provide their expertise. And actually, currently, our chair is actually appointed by the employer as an expert, given her background of what she's done in the past. So that's the eight. And then on the employee side, you have six appointed by employees through their labor representative in the PSCBC, in the Public Service Coordinating Bargaining Council. So they will decide and they will bring those names. One is a pensioner representative. That is by election. So every 4 years, an election is conducted amongst pensioners to actually appoint a pensioner representative and an alternate. And then one, again, is an election by the uniformed forces to appoint from their own ranks. The ages. Why do we... I think it's... So the GPF tries to report in the same way that all other public entities have to report. So we follow the best practice of, say, King 4. So we look at what other... Our investing companies... How do we expect our investing companies to report in terms of King 4? And we tend to follow suit. So we don't hold other people to a standard that we don't hold ourselves to. So it's simply that the normal reporting standard in South Africa requires that you actually give some information about the people that are serving on the board, and age is one of those, so we do. But I don't think it's important.
Although the younger members on the board were concerned, they asked why should their ages be...
They asked the same question.
It is very worrisome on the fact that you are not engaged with this matter of a bailout to ESCOM. But when you were presenting, Chairperson, you said anything that is exceed 2 billion, you get engaged by the PIC. But in this regard, there was no engagement, nothing. Another thing I want to highlight, Chair, you know, majority of the workers in South Africa, they have no shelter. And the reason being affordability. They can't afford to buy a house. In future, if this GPEF money can be used to cover all those things, to bail out actually workers in circumstances like those ones, I think it will be very good because it will serve the workers' interest. And instead of taking the money to the corrupt SOEs that are failing to create their own revenue, every now and then we hear about bailouts, but there's nothing happening, there's no improvement, nothing. Thank you.
Okay. No. I think, Honorable Mhlala, we have agreed that the issue of ESCOM, not more than 2 weeks, we should meet GPF, PIC, unions. I'm not sure if ESCOM is relevant. I'm not sure whether it's ESCOM that applied or is the unions that started with that idea of bailing out ESCOM. Maybe let's have ESCOM. It's a public entity. It's good if they are in this meeting. So the secretariat will make sure that sooner we have that meeting. And the issue of housing, Honorable Mhlala, remember government works in a coordinated manner. There are schemes in human settlement that address the low income, which you call RDP house, the middle income in terms of social houses and flicks and all those. They've got various categories. Those who can't afford to get a loan from the bank on their own. So government does what they call a top-up of some kind. Then the financial institutions are able to come in that. You see the police, people who are working in the administration and they are at lower ranks, after paying for school fees, transport and the like, they can't afford the bond. So there is a special scheme for such kind of categories. Can we have the last round follow-ups, then we adjourn the meeting so that we allow people to prepare for so on. Vessels and Skosan. The only three.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just on the salary increase of the PEO, the 19%, I didn't get an answer on that. Thanks. On the reserve...
So it's a benchmark. I think the chairperson touched on it. So salaries are benchmark, and we do adjustments after a salary benchmark based on a number of criteria that we use, number of years experience or qualifications, and how the market has moved over time. Included in the remuneration is allowances. So if we pay out leave, for example, that would also be included in that. There was a period where we paid out leave to the principal executive officer. So those things add up. That's where it comes. So it's a once-off adjustment. It was not a 19% salary increase from year to year. It's a whole host of allowances and a bonus as well as an increase that is done based on benchmarks. Yeah.
Thank you. If you could just answer me on the reserves that you have, what your current reserve level is. I may have missed that, but I don't think you answered that. And then, sir, you were saying you had two answers, Mr. Sotali, you had two answers on the consequences of a downgrade. You gave me the first answer, but the second one was, would that prevent you from any new purchases going to those bonds, yeah, going forward?
That's the reserve.
The contingency reserve is 137 million. The actuary said we should be on 720 million, but we can only afford 127 billion.
Yeah.
127 billion.
Yeah.
They're saying we should be on 720 billion, but we can only afford 120 billion. Yes.
On the bond is the we have a credit rating matrix that says what is the credit rating of an entity that we can invest in. So if the entities then were to fall below that, then we'll not be putting any more money. But the existing money would remain.
Kosan?
Yeah, well, on the question that I raised, which the PO has answered regarding the stain of scandal, that is saying, no, the PIC is doing a lot in order to avoid that. But my question was focusing on the GEPF, to say what is it that the GEPF is doing differently. Because in terms of that answer, it means you are putting all your trust in the PIC, and then you are folding your arms to say, no, I'm lifting my eyes on the mountain where my help will come from, in terms of the Bible verse. So I want to know, what are you doing as the GEPF differently? Because you can't just give the PIC a blank check and fold your arms and say, no, they are dealing with that. They were happy that they will resolve that. Because you've got a responsibility. I think workers, they put their money on you. You see, so it's you who are accountable to the workers. So what is it that you are doing in terms of how you relate to the PIC? Thanks.
So now I understand the question in two parts. So there is the commercial investment, which I answered partly, but I can attach to it. But then you talk about issues of governance. So how do we change our governance from that perspective? So what I answered was more on the commercial side. It's about making sure that your analysis is improved, making sure that your due diligence is improved. So I think that's what I indicated. And then from a governance perspective, as the chair has indicated, you're not focusing on Steinhoff, you're focusing on the process. So she spoke about we are reviewing a mandate. And this, before the Empathy Commission, we started reviewing our mandate and our investment policy statement to ensure that we tighten up in the governance processes not just for any specific investment per se, but broadly how we actually are doing the investments. But the Chair, I think, spoke about the things that we're doing in terms of improving the mandate, the investment policy statement. I'm not sure if you want to add something, Chair.
I just wanted to, maybe it's repeating what I said already, that when you have a Steinhoff, we engage with the PIC, we ask what are the lessons learned, what went wrong, and then on the basis of that, talk about what it is that should be done differently by them as well as by us, depending on what the situation is. And in our engagement with the board-to-board engagements, one of the things that we have been emphasizing is that due diligence process, looking at the investment processes themselves, and also having stronger monitoring processes on the PIC side, because they are at the coal face of things. And so what we can do is to highlight there are weaknesses in the way that you're doing things, or we would like you to do things differently in order to mitigate these risks that we observe as the asset owner. So that's how we've been handling it. And as I said, the heightened engagement at the board level helps us to ensure that the issues that we identify are dealt with at the governance level, because it's not in all instances that matters can be corrected by executives when you identify problems. So the governance relationship between these two entities is quite critical to ensure that we are well aligned in the interest of the people that we serve.
Okay. Thanks very much, Chairperson of the Board of GPF, Dr. Mkate and Mr. Stolle. There are colleagues who are present here, Musa, and then honorable members, our visitors, media. The next time that we meet is next week, isn't it? There will be a lock-up next week on Wednesday for the budget before the minister presents. Yes, and Minister of Finance will brief the committees on Thursday. So, as from next week, our program will be very tight because we'll be dealing with processing the budget. But in between this meeting with GPF, PIC, and the unions on the ESCOM bailout is very critical. So we'll find a way that within the program of processing the budget, we have an hour or two to deal with this matter of public interest. So we'll try to strike a balance in the program. Thanks very much. The meeting is adjourned.